Morning. We'll call this meeting to order of the Housing Finance and Policy Division. Seeing that quorum is present, has anyone had a chance to review the minutes for Wednesday, March 13th? Representative Johnson?
Chair Howard, I was reviewing the minutes, and if I recall correctly, we did not have a quorum when we started last week, and we never did approve the minutes from last week, so that needs to be removed from the current minutes before we can approve these.
I don't remember. We can check that, and if we need to come back and approve those minutes, then we can do that tonight since we're coming back tonight. Okay. In that case, we can move on to the first bill on the agenda, which is Representative Hausman with House File 1151. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I will move House File 1151 to get that before us.
And Representative Hausman moves 1151 before us and to be later possible inclusion. And you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have had lots of testimony and lots of motivation for working hard on the issue of housing for those who don't have a safe place to sleep at night. This morning's newspaper, if you're a newspaper reader, this morning's Star Tribune had a front page story. Insurer spends big on housing, and they talk about United Healthcare's work on investing $400 million in housing people. And what they said is this is a national trend where insurers and healthcare providers are trying to address the lack of affordable housing and other social determinants of health in hopes of helping control medical costs. In a few cases, United Healthcare has more directly financed projects that provide housing for people who previously were homeless and now require fewer trips to the hospital or emergency room. And the doctor says, I think everyone in healthcare is realizing that housing is healthcare. So every day there's another reason to be motivated to come here and to work hard, and that's what we're doing today. So we're addressing now House File 1151. I'm pleased to discuss this bill today, which includes a number of Minnesota housing-related housing measures supported by the Homes for All Coalition. That coalition has organized more than 200 groups around the state working so hard to bring this issue to all of us. Thank you to so many of the committee members for signing on to the bill. Over the course of the past few months, we've heard about the growing affordable housing crisis in Minnesota is facing along the full continuum of housing, everything from homelessness, rental assistance programs, housing preservation, new development, and affordable homeownership. Just a few of the updated statistics from Minnesota Housing Partnership and the Wilder Foundation that we've seen in the last couple of weeks. Minnesota Housing Partnership says more than one in four, or over 572,000 households in Minnesota, pay more than they can afford for housing. That number has grown by nearly 26,000 households from 2015 to 2017. That's how rapidly the number is growing. The Wilder Foundation's release of their report was from 2015 to 2018, homelessness in Minnesota has gone up a whopping 10%. 9% in the metro, 13% in rural areas. So it's growing faster in greater Minnesota. In large part, that is a growing senior population, I believe, in greater Minnesota. The statistics are stark, and one can draw a connection that we absolutely need to do more, and we must act now. So the package that you have before you today includes a $2 million increase for the Bridges program, which we already heard about last week, thanks to Representative Bierman, for chief authoring that bill, a $15 million increase for the Challenge Program. We also already heard about that longstanding successful program, thanks to Representative Gunther for continuing to champion Challenge. $8 million for Homework Starts with Home, $10 million for a local housing trust fund match, that's one-time funding, and $200,000 for capacity building grants to support tenant hotline services. And that was, I think, Representative Howard. We're grateful to you for carrying these bills. And the committee will hear about them later this morning. This bill also includes a $4 million biennial base increase for the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. And I'm joined today by two testifiers for the YMCA and the Tribal Collaborative who are going to speak specifically to that program.
Chair, committee members, my name is Betty Nato, and I'm the Youth Support Program Director at the YMCA. I focus on homeless prevention, housing placement, and outreach services. Established in 1993, the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, or FHPAP, has been a vital part of Minnesota's homeless response system. And in most regions across the state, FHPAP is the primary or sole homeless prevention resource. Currently, approximately 5,300 households are served per year who are at risk of or experiencing homelessness. This means we spend just $1,600 per household. FHPAP has been a successful model in helping to stabilize housing for many Minnesotans. An example of this is a young mom the YMCA recently served. She had fallen behind on rent because she was fired from her job when her daughter was sick. She had found a great job but needed to get caught up on rent and safe, reliable child care for her daughter. The YMCA was able to pay her off her back rent and obtain child care. This alleviated stress and the fear of eviction so she could focus on the future. We're seeking an increase of $4 million per biennium to FHPAP's base funding primarily for two reasons. One, to help increase the ability to cover unmet needs. So on average, regions across the state are turning away 4 to 5 households to every one household we're able to serve. And two, funds are not equitably distributed across the state. As regions have been added, which you'll hear about in a little bit, Minnesota Housing's funding distribution model has created two problems. Regions that are newer to FHPAP are largely underfunded and struggle to make a significant impact in their community. And regions that were initially funded by FHPAP have been getting steady decreases in funding to accommodate the new regions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1151 and specifically the FHPAP portion of this request. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Pete Charpentier, and I'm the Homes for All Regional Lead for the Central Minnesota Continuum of Care and the Minnesota Tribal Collaborative to Prevent and End Homelessness. The Central COC represents 13 Central Minnesota counties, and the Tribal Collaborative originally represented 5 Northern Ojibwe tribes, Mille Lacs, White Earth, Boys Fort, Leech Lake, and Red Lake. Fond du Lac joined the Tribal Collaborative this year. Tribal entities were first allowed to apply for FHPAP funds during the previous biennium. The overall funding of FHPAP was not increased to reflect the larger pool of applicants. The Tribal Collaborative applied for the FHPAP grant and received $309,000 to be distributed among 5 tribal entities over a 2-year period. Once these funds were allocated, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe had approximately $16,000 to assist families in preventing homelessness. This amount allowed the Mille Lacs Band to serve 0.43 families per quarter. Additional funds would need to be leveraged in order to realistically prevent a family from an episode of homelessness. As an example of how this was accomplished, the Mille Lacs Band wraparound program was able to assist a single parent of 2 teenagers, one of whom is disabled. The woman had been temporarily unable to work due to medical issues. She was at risk of being evicted. The wraparound program was able to negotiate with the property owner to pay 3 months of past due rent and avoid eviction. The wraparound program needed to leverage additional funds to assist this woman because the expenses were far greater than the amount of FHPAP funds available. Utilizing $800 from FHPAP and $1,450 from leverage funds, the wraparound program helped this woman and her children remain stably housed. The staff time needed to assist this family was not included in the FHPAP funding. Overall, the investment required to aid this family greatly exceeded the amount of funding that FHPAP provided. In another example, Boys Fort was able to assist a 40-year-old woman who was at risk of having her utility service discontinued. The program staff negotiated with Lake Country Power and completed paperwork in order to avoid an interruption in service. In this instance, FHPAP funds were utilized to prevent a lease violation, which could have resulted in an eviction. While this was certainly helpful, it does not address the needs of people facing eviction due to unpaid rent. An increase of $4 million to the FHPAP base funding would be a step toward addressing unmet needs in rural Minnesota and tribal communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other testifiers that would like to testify to this bill? I think we can move on to member questions. Are there any member questions?
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment I would like to offer.
Representative Tice has an amendment.
The
A1 amendment. Representative Tice.
My voice isn't very good today. We have talked about with the governor's task force with needing to build 300,000 homes in just, you know, really a short amount of time. And we're not even sure we can build affordable. So I wish we would have talked more about what to do with codes and how we can make maybe some of the costs a little less intrusive into what we would find for housing. It really would have been a really great discussion to talk about, to get the groups all together. We had one day where we had a lot of folks talking about some of the permit costs and some of the costs associated with building homes. But it would have been great to have a commission on figuring out how we can all work together to see if there's some ways that we can make the permitting process and the cost of building a little bit cheaper. We just really struggle to do that. I mean, when we were building, we could build a single level home for, you know, just a little over $100,000. Now you're, you know, two and a half times that. We just can't do it. And so I think if we're going to look at some of the recommendations from the governor's task force, we really need to look at what's driving the cost up. And so I am offering the amendment. I think it would be a good start for us to look at what some of the costs are. I am going to pull it, but I think it's worth the discussion. We really do need to look at the cost of housing. We can do the grants and we can do all that, but if we can't build new housing, because a lot of areas need housing, it's not just for homeless. It's also for some of the docs and the professionals that work at our hospitals. It's also, and I'm sure that's part of a reason why United Healthcare would do something like that, is because they just don't have the housing for the workforce at every level, not just, you know, entry level, but all levels. And that's something we need to look at as well, because if we're going to get folks, hopefully, into a home and into jobs, then that's what we need to look at as well, is do they have the housing they need for the jobs that they can get. So I really wish we would have talked more about that, but I know we don't have a lot of time because we only meet once a week. That is a barrier. But I really do believe it is a huge step forward in looking at how do we build for what our communities need. I know what I need in St. Cloud is different than what, say, Dan Fabian needs up in Roseau. Deb Crookston talks the same thing about the college. They can't find places for the college workers, professors, and all those folks where they can live. And so we got to find ways to really say, how do we get our cost of housing down? When our neighboring states do a better job than we do, we need to figure out what that is. And I really hope that we can look at this really seriously next year, because I think it's something we really need to do. It needs to be a part of what we talk about. I'm sure at some point we've got Habitat that does a lot of work in our community, a lot of work. And now they're starting to do veterans build as well. But they have the same costs that any other builder will have. And so we're looking at, we really need to look at how do we keep those costs down so that we don't lose programs like Habitat, because they can't build cheap enough. They can't build at the level that we need to have it at. And it's changed most dramatically, I would say, in the last 10, 12 years. So what's changed? And we need to look at that. So with that, I will withdraw the amendment, but I really wanted to have the discussion that I thought it was really important that we do keep on track to do things like starting a commission on home affordability. I think it's a large part of what we do, and especially when we hear that United Care is investing that much money. I mean, it has a lot to do with they just don't have the housing for the folks that they need to hire. And that's really a sad scenario that we can't keep up with that, knowing that the states on our borders can. They're building a lot cheaper than we are. Why are we so expensive? So thank you.
So, Representative Tice, just to clarify, so you're withdrawing the amendment, you're saying. You may recall we had a hearing in which Dolly came and talked about the state law. They're required by state law to adopt codes that lower construction costs. The group, I think, that's going to carry it forward after the governor's task force on housing came out, so that it didn't stop there, Prosperity's Front Door was formed, and one of their three goals is lowering costs. So I'm assuming there will be some effort with that group to, in fact, do that. But thank you for withdrawing the amendment.
And Representative Hausman, to the bill.
I think there are no questions. We're probably ready to move on to yours.
All right. And with that, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Start with 1402.
That is correct.
So you're moving 1402, and is that an author's amendment?
We do have one amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like it, so I would move that amendment.
Representative Howard moves 1402, and he also moves an author's amendment, A2, to get the bill before us. To the author's amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, that bill is now before us as you intend.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is 1402, providing a state match for local housing trust funds. And I want to thank Representative Haley for carrying authorizing legislation in the previous biennium and to the bipartisan group of legislators that are co-authoring and working on this bill. Around the country, there are more than 700 housing trust funds in cities and counties and states that generate in excess of $1 billion. In Minnesota, communities like Winona, Alexandria, Wabasha, St. Cloud, and Red Wing Red Wing's actually moved forward, but some of these communities are trying to consider creating their own local housing trust funds and how best to serve their communities. And local housing trust funds are a tool that the state, I believe, should incentivize to make sure that local communities can meet the needs of their own communities. And I want to highlight a few elements why local housing trust funds really are a tool that serves Minnesota well. First, local housing trust funds provide local governments with an opportunity to determine the outcomes of their funds and determine how to use them in their own communities. And we've had a lot of discussion this session in the committee about how there are housing challenges and needs all across the state of Minnesota, but those needs look differently in different communities. Local housing trust funds have the ability to allow communities to lead and tailor solutions to their various communities. And second, the flexibility and local control allows for more innovation. And third, trust funds enable local communities to leverage private and public funds. Once established, these trust funds have the possibility of leveraging significant private investment. So it's an efficient use of our state dollars. And so the bottom line is more tools are needed. The need is great all across our state, and local housing trust funds are a tool that will help us meet our affordable housing challenges all across our state. And with that, I would turn it over to my first testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Randall Hammerlin. I'm the executive director of the Red Wing Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And thank you for...
I will tell you, sir, that I quote you very often.
Oh, thank you.
What I've learned from you about these particular issues. And
thank you.
So I thank you for being
appreciate
here.
Appreciate that. That's very kind of you. Thank you for having me here today to listen to what I have to say about what we call it, an affordable housing trust fund, but it is a local housing trust fund is a good way to talk about these. We brought our local housing trust fund into being after 2015. We experienced, as many people in Southeast Minnesota have, a tremendous shortage of housing, and it all ties back to the economy. We had a study done in 2014 that showed that 6,600 workers were driving into Red Wing every day in order to work. Well, that's even increased now to over 10,000 people a day, and yet our housing is not keeping pace with that type of growth of employers. So this is connected not only to the people who need the housing themselves, but also to our employers who need people to work for them. And we have good growth in Red Wing, and it's been actually quite prosperous. Our unemployment rate is about less than 3.1%, is my understanding. So we were trying to figure out what it is we can do. We came up with the idea of this Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and we are right now funding it through what we our HRA tax levy funds. At the time we went to the city council with it, we were receiving about $300,000 a year. Now they bumped that up to $400,000 a year, which is my max that I can do by state statute. And of that, $100,000 a year goes into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And we have a memorandum with the city, and the city council is very involved in it. I can explain that in just a moment. But the HRA is the administrator of this Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Since 2015, we had this last year, we had just under $300,000 in the account. Anyone, you know, some people might say, well, that's not a lot of money. But I think, as Representative Howard said, what we have to look at is this is a leverage account. And we are using that in that regard. We're looking at a home buyer's assistance program that we created, and we have already closed 7 loans, and my leverage on that is $15 to 1. I have $9,000 home buyer's assistance loans, and that's leveraging anything from a $60,000 condo that we closed on to a $225,000 Habitat for Humanity house. The next thing we're working on right now is a $72,000 that are going to be used for single-family housing rehab. We have some homes in Red Wing that are aging very rapidly, depreciating out. They need a lot of attention. That's very valuable when you have a tremendous shortage of housing already. Every unit counts. So we're trying to rehab those houses. And then one of the other more exciting things that we're just starting on, and I got the approval by the city council for this on Monday night, and that is a $150,000 request for proposals to do a small site development in the downtown, what we call Old West Main Pottery Place areas in Red Wings, to find a underutilized site, a blighted site, a spot that has a place that we could put up to 6 units of housing. This will leverage, I would assume, 10 to 1. All these funds require no other work with other agencies. We have the money. We're using it, and it's exciting in that regard. Now, last year, I worked on a tax increment finance project, and 250 units was approved. Of those 250 units, we're going to have about $14 million of tax increment that's going to be generated. The city council agreed that we would be able to put in, and we're expecting up to $100,000 a year for 25 years into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. If we did not have the trust fund as a tool available for us, I don't think that would have even been thought about. So that in itself is a reason to have a trust fund, is to say that when these opportunities come along, we have a place to put the money, we know what we're going to do with it, we're going to administer it. We have a community advisory council that works with me on this, so there's actually 3 tiers I go through when I do any kind of work on it, and that is the Community Advisory Committee, the HRA Board, and the City Council. All three have to agree on how the use of the funds are. So we're excited, and the housing needs in southeast Minnesota are tremendous right now. Basically, Goodhue County is at 0% vacancy across the board. The county itself has created an affordable housing trust fund as well, based on the model that we used in Red Wing. So when we're talking about providing a one-time match, as we were talking about today, it would be a tremendous boost for us to start the projects going, to start the Affordable Housing Trust Fund going in other communities. We have one already in Red Wing. We're going to go with ours. The one more thing I can mention on ours is that it's got enough energy, enough support, that it's now been placed in the newest 10-year strategic plan at the City Council level, that this the Affordable Housing Trust Fund is going to be continued and find different ways to fund it, as well as the HRA tax levy. So with that, I'd like to encourage you to consider this bill.
Thank you, sir. And do we have a testifier from the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, I believe?
Great.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderardi for Metro Cities, which represents the collective interests of cities across the seven-county metropolitan region. A number of cities have established local housing trust funds over the years. In fact, the legislature clarified the process a couple of years ago, and that has spurred kind of an orderly process for more cities to adopt the policy and create their own local housing trust funds. I want to thank Representative Howard for bringing the bill forward, and would encourage a state match for those local housing trust fund efforts. It will help amplify what local funds are raised and allow local communities to meet more locally identified housing needs. So encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further testimony? Representative Howard?
I don't think so.
Questions? Representative Fuhrman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for the last two testifiers. When we're talking about local affordable housing in the different communities, I think this is a really good idea as far as being able to give local communities that ability to use the funds as they see fit. But is there a benchmark of what, in a dollar amount, local affordable housing is in these communities that you're shooting at?
Well, when we first started in Red Wing talking about affordable housing, we were actually thinking we could look at $200,000 single-family homes. That's not the case anymore at all. We just did a brand new Habitat for Humanity house that we helped with the Home Buyers Assistance Program from the trust fund. It was $225,000, and that's with donated materials and donated help. I think we're probably closer to single-family homes being $250,000 to $300,000 as the cost. Now, if you go into townhouses and other types of, I think we can get that cost down to about $180,000 if we're building new. Now, one of the most important things too is to remember maintaining these existing houses out there is very important. That's our naturally occurring affordable housing. And so to tie into this, we have to have ways to find suitable housing for seniors, so that they can move out of their natural occurring affordable housing to make it open up for workforce, and then we provide the rehab dollars.
Representative Tice?
Madam Chair, I just have a question. With the amendment, it talks about an advisory group. So should this have a stop in government operations?
I have to read the amendment. Representative Howard, you reference an advisory group, but this is not a new advisory group. You aren't establishing one here. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, this amendment represents conversations with our cities and just trying to create a stakeholder group to consider legislation, and perhaps Mr. Vanderardi might be able to testify to it as well. In terms of the intent of the stakeholder group.
We're going to lay this over, but we'll be certain to check that out to make certain that that we don't inadvertently.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that, you know, we don't get hung up because of that, it should have gone to government operations.
We're laying this bill over, but we need to determine that before before we close it up.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yes, further comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Tice, the bill was silent on how the state would appropriate the funds to the actual local units that establish the funds, and so this is a group that would help the state figure out if the funds are undersubscribed, oversubscribed, what the process for actually getting the funds to the local and regional housing trust funds would look like.
Okay, Madam Chair, just as long as we make sure that it doesn't get hung up because it should have gone there.
Madam Chair Hausman, I believe Representative Tice is correct because the amendment says shall create the advisory group.
We will certainly check that out before we go forward. Any further? I don't see any other questions. Any concluding comments on 1402?
No, Madam Chair, I'd encourage support. I think this is a bill that really fits with our overall objective this session, which is to address our affordable housing crisis in ways that is nimble and responds to the unique challenges all across the state.
So Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 1402 be, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion, and we will check that inquiry out. And now we are going to take up 2336. Is that correct?
I believe so, yep.
Representative Howard, would you like to make that motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2336.
And you have speaking to the bill.
I believe some of these stats were just referenced, but according to the Minnesota Housing Partnership's recent State of the State housing report, there are more than 600,000 people who rent their home in Minnesota. More and more households are either needing to rent because of increasing housing costs or choosing to rent for a variety of reasons, and as we know, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans are cost burdened. Rental housing is a regulated business that involves a mix of complicated local, state, and federal laws, as well as detailed lease provisions. This can be challenging for renters to navigate alone. And since 2013, state funding has been appropriated for the nonprofit organization Homeline to support their statewide hotline for renters. This hotline provides free legal and practical advice to all Minnesota tenants regarding their rental housing situation. Last year, the governor's task force on housing recommended Homeline as a resource that the state should support and expand on. And additionally, this funding is included in the Homes for All legislative agenda that was heard in House File 1151. House File 2336 increases the investment the state will make through Minnesota Housing to ensure that renters have free, confidential, and convenient access to information about their rights as tenants. And I want to speak specifically to my experience with Homeline in our community when we had, as we've discussed somewhat in this committee, a situation at Crossroads at Penn where over 1,000 residents were given a note slipped under the door basically saying they had 30 days to vacate. And the amount of kind of panic and concern for these renters was so significant, and Homeline was an invaluable resource for those tenants to figure out what options they did have to help locate housing. And I truly believe that without that assistance from Homeline, we would have seen many families be homeless just because they, in that time of need, that sort of resource that Homeline provides is just so important. And so Homeline's tenant hotline is something that Minnesotans already rely on, and we need to ensure that the growing and diverse renter populations continues to have access to these core services. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Samuel Spade. I am a staff attorney at Homeline and Homeline's research director. I have practiced a Minnesota landlord tenant law, residential landlord tenant law, since 2009. I've personally advised approximately 15,000 Minnesota residential tenants. Homeline is a nonprofit organization, as you heard, that provides free, legal, practical advice that is confidential. We're a tenant hotline to the residents throughout the state of Minnesota. Since its founding in 1992, we've helped or advised over 230,000 residential tenants. About 20 to 25% of our calls come from Greater Minnesota, with the remainder coming from the metro area. Our hotline averages about 1,000 calls per month. And in 2019, we're on pace to advise more tenants than in any prior year. On average, about 85% of the tenants who call us for legal advice are low income. Many of these families work low-wage jobs or have fixed incomes. They might not qualify for other income-qualified programs, though. We advise tenants in four languages, English, Spanish, Somali, and Hmong. We can be contacted by phone or email. We review documents for tenants. Tenants can contact us more than once if they need to about the same issue to ask for continuing advice on that. We work with topics and we work with clients who are struggling with very important situations in their lives, situations that affect their housing, their health and safety, their financial well-being. And we are able, in the best case scenarios, to prevent homelessness, help them get repairs, help them save money. It's just something I've been able to witness advising tenants on the hotline. But part of being a legal services organization also means offering accurate legal advice. Unfortunately, this sometimes means walking tenants through very difficult situations, walking them through evictions where they may not have defenses, talking with them about how to approach settlement, just understand the court process in general. In addition to the above, our hotline really answers almost any landlord-tenant question that a tenant asks us. This can be, you know, how do I give a notice to vacate? How do I give a proper notice to vacate? How do I deal with my security deposit or, you know, a change of ownership or something along those lines? We're also able to respond to seasonal issues such as heat in the winter or topical issues such as all of the flooding caused by this year's record snowfall melting, the ice dams, and so on. This expertise we've obtained through advising tenants throughout Minnesota, it means that we can extend our expertise beyond just advising tenants. We're able to offer trainings to landlords, attorneys, social workers, police, city inspectors, and other groups that work with or support tenants. We publish books on Minnesota landlord-tenant law for both tenants and landlords, and we're a common referral source for the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, cities, counties, social workers, and more, sometimes even landlords. In general, as you heard, we're a resource that tenants already rely on. We thank you for your continuing support and for the opportunity to testify today.
Any further testimony to the bill? I don't see any questions here. Any further? Representative Heisen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Howard, will the funds go directly to Homeline to help? Are they the only group that's being offered to do free and confidential legal advice, or is this it?
Representative Howard?
Homeline is really the statewide leader here, and I'll see if other folks want to just jump in too.
Mr. Dahl, welcome to
Madam Chair, Representative Tice, it's a common practice to name a service that you want to provide in legislation and not assume the organization that might receive it, because who knows, down the road someone or some organization might be better equipped to handle the situation. That said, Homeline right now is the only statewide tenant advocacy organization, and we, we're applying, going to be applying for these services.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howard, I am a little bit concerned because they are a lobbying group, and that is concerning that we're doing that. And if there's some other folks out there, I just really hope they come forward as well, and we look for additional options and just don't go. It's just concerning. I wanted to bring that forward.
Mr. Dahl, further comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Tice. Actually, a number of nonprofits both provide services and then also advice to the state on different issues that their constituency needs. I can say is that the resources for the that we're asking for are being used solely for our tenant hotline services. We have a $670,000 service that we provide through the tenant hotline, and this would help meet the gap in the advice that we're providing to tenants. Again, that said, the constituency that we work with, we do try to gather what their concerns and needs are and bring those concerns to the state. And that's not an uncommon process.
Okay. Thank you.
I see. Questions? Concluding comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the committee for the discussion. I look forward to your support.
Thank you. So Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 2336 be laid over for possible inclusion. And we're moving on to your third one, House File 1401. And there is, I believe, an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, first I'd move 1401. And then, as you mentioned, I do have an author's amendment.
Howard moves 1401, and he further moves the DE1 amendment. That said, delete everything. So we'll get that before us, because that's the one you're actually discussing. So the DE1, the author's amendment, is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? That bill is before us now as the author intends.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Homework Starts with Home bill. I'm very proud to author this bill and thank the bipartisan authors that are working on this in both the House and the Senate. At the heart of this bill lies, I think, a fundamental truth that unless our kids have access to stable housing, they are not going to be prepared to succeed in the classroom. And if we are to improve educational outcomes and truly narrow our immoral opportunity gap, we must concern ourselves with our housing crisis and must acknowledge the link between housing and education. And this legislation and this initiative tackles that issue head on. The challenges across our state is real. According to the Department of Education, on a single night during the 2017-2018 school year, there were nearly 8,700 students experiencing homelessness in Minnesota. And this is a problem all across our state. This issue affected over 1,000 schools in 300 districts in 76 of the 87 counties across our state. The challenges do highlight also our gaps in equity. American Indian students are 6 times overrepresented in our population experiencing homelessness, and our black students are more than 4 times likely to experience homelessness. Homework Starts with Home is an innovative initiative that seeks to improve housing stability for families through direct housing rental assistance and improved collaboration between our schools and housing providers. Statistics from the pilot project, and we'll hear more about that, show that this is a worthy investment and it's working. We should be reinvesting this program on a consistent basis and continuing to grow our investment in programs that serve our students and acknowledge that when our students have stable housing, they're going to be better prepared to succeed. I really think this is one of the most common sense smart investments we'll see before this committee, before this legislature, this session. And with that, I will turn it over to my first testifier.
We have two testifiers at the table. Trisha Kaufman is first. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Trisha Kaufman. I'm the Executive Director of Solid Ground, and we're the lead agency and the fiscal agent for the new Suburban Homework Starts with Home program for the 4 school districts that serve suburban Ramsey and Washington County. And our partnership is made up of 10 organizations representing housing, social services, education, and faith communities. The number of families experiencing homelessness or at risk of imminent homelessness in our community is rising at unprecedented rates. In just the past 10 years, students in Moundsview, Roseville, Wiper Lake, Oakdale, North St. Paul, and Maplewood school districts experiencing homelessness has increased by fourfold. And we last year we served more than 800 students who identified as homeless or housing instability. There are also significant disparities among students experiencing homelessness in the four districts. In White Bear Lake, for example, students of color made up 26% of the total student population, but 57% of those experiencing housing instability. And our partnership specifically targets families from indigenous communities, students of color, and other underserved populations that are disproportionately impacted. Our community doesn't have much access to shelter, and the ones we have are full. Our housing waiting lists are full. A growing number of families who experience homelessness simply cannot afford the rental rates in the current market. They have limited incomes, poor credit, maybe criminal histories. The families that we serve in our pilot program also experience things like mental and chemical health issues. They have children with special needs. They might be fleeing domestic violence. Children and parents who experience trauma are re-traumatized when they're forced to sleep in their cars or bounce around from place to place because they have nowhere to call home. And meanwhile, those students fall further and further behind in school. The Homework Starts with Home program can change all that. Social workers from the school districts refer families directly to Solid Ground's Housing Navigator, who helps them find housing they can sustain in the long run. We help them find work or better paying work that they can use to afford housing on their own. But until that time, the rental assistance from the program helps them afford that housing. Our partnership is new, and we've only been serving families for a few months now. The first family we served, a mom with four kids, had been living in a hotel for more than 6 months. She actually worked full-time, but she still couldn't afford a place to rent. But with help from our housing navigator and rental assistance from the Homework Starts with Home program, this family is now living in a safe and clean three-bedroom apartment. The kids are going to school every day. They have a place to do their homework and a place to lay their head at night. Their opportunities and their futures are a lot brighter because they have a place to call home. And there are so many more families in our community and across the state who need help. We really hope that you will support our request to fund the Homework Starts with Home program. Thank you.
And we have another testifier. Is this a parent advocate? Is that correct?
Yes.
So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name
you
is
might want to pull that back.
My name is Dominice Perkins.
Welcome. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, coming from a family with a history of drugs and abuse, I'm a young lady with dreams and goals but didn't know how to put that into use. Now a struggling mom just wanting better for my children, doing my very best and still struggling to do it. Homeless for 8 months with four babies and no help, almost ready to give up, but my children didn't ask to be here. Pushing forward and doing all that I can, working three jobs just to hear my children are failing again. What more can I do? I have to pay the bills. If I don't go to work, it makes it very hard for us to live. No time for my children who are having behavior problems and learning issues. They are struggling in school, but keeping a roof over my head is all that I can do. I'm reaching out for support because things are getting very stressful. At school, they ask me about our issues and offer resources that can be helpful. One of the programs for homework starts with home, a program that told me that I wasn't going through this alone, a program that could have they cared about my family and the problems in our home. And it's a lot of issues that we needed to address, education facing homelessness, and working to provide the little that I had. We figured out a plan and resources, too. Now they're helping me with housing and supporting my children to do better in school. This program is very important.
Thank you for being
Thank
here.
Thank you.
We have seen the targets that are out, and our committee's target is $26 million, $10 million of which is one-time money. The education target is $900 million. That's a high priority for us. But we see the strong connection, as you are all telling the story, of stability in the lives of children. The University of Minnesota research that that shows that by the time a child reaches fifth grade, if they've been homeless or highly mobile, they're achieving at the level of a second grader who's been in stable housing. So the strong connection between the work we have to do and that investment we're making in the education bill, there is a connection between them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a really great point. And just when you look at our overall state budget, just to underscore that, you know, the education budget is, I think, the largest piece of the pie. But if we're not focused at the core of what is going to create opportunity for success, stable housing, you know, those investments won't be as effective. And so that speaks to the importance, efficiency, effectiveness of a program like Homework Starts with Home.
Representative Juergens has a question.
More of a comment, Madam Chair. Yesterday I had the opportunity to go to Dakota County for a follow-up meeting from the point in time count where we shared our notes, shared stories, shared, you know, what did we learn and what can we learn to do better next time. And one of the stories that I heard was a single mother living in her car with four kids. She would park the car as close to the school as possible so that she wouldn't have to burn unnecessary gas. In this case, they were fleeing domestic violence. They were in temporary housing for a period of time. One of the kids then reached out to his or her father, who then learned where they were, so they had to flee again. And I'm not sure how this program would have helped that family, but I know that it helps families. And the interesting thing is that we asked, well, what's the biggest challenge with placing people in housing? And it's navigating the system. It's the paperwork. It's you have a voucher. You might even have an apartment that's located, but in order to get the inspection done in time, or oftentimes the inspection is not done in time and the voucher expires. And so these people were that close to finding housing, and then they lose it. And then they have to go through the whole process again. So, again, I'm not sure this program specifically how that might have helped that family, but I know that it does help families. And Ms. Perkins, thank you for coming today to tell us your story as well. But it always, when you hear those stories, real life stories, it brings it home. It's not just what we see on paper. It's not just what we hear in this committee, but it's real life. It's real people. And I just want to thank Representative Howard for bringing this forward.
And what I've learned from Representative Juergens, who has so personally experienced this in your district, is it becomes real to you as you do the count and then as you follow up. So we've learned from you.
Madam Chair, Representative Juergens, thank you for those comments. And what I think specifically increasing resources to this program does is going to allow us to create more community-based solutions throughout the state. And that's one of, I think, the innovative and attractive parts of this program is we're allowing communities to come with their own solutions. So we have, through the pilot project, you know, pockets where there's communities that are utilizing these resources. And so with increased funding, I think we will be able to take this effective model to more communities and serve more families.
And one other thing too that I promised I would talk to you about, so we maybe have a few minutes afterwards. But House File 1043, not on the agenda today, but that does increase the amount of money that the counties have available to help place the people. It increases by $100 a month from $900 to $1,000 in the available rent assistance. So, as we know, rent keeps going up, and I don't think that number's been adjusted for several years. So if we could maybe visit after.
We've made a note.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard, thank you. On Friday, I was at McKinley, which is an area learning center, and what I hear most from them is the amount of students that are homeless. And it's not just the families. It's they're on their own, and they're homeless. And it strikes me today that maybe if we would have these programs in place earlier, a lot of these students now would not be homeless. In St. Cloud, we're very fortunate that one of our Rotary clubs has, it's called Pathways for Youth, and it's basically a center where students can go. They can't stay there. They'll help them find a place to stay for the night, but they can go there and shower, use the computer's Wi-Fi system, have some food, things like that. But if we would have had this in place a lot earlier, we maybe wouldn't see the amount of teenage homeless folks we have there now. And I'm really, anything to do with, you know, you put read in it or homework, and I'm okay with it. I just think it's something we really need to take seriously. This is a huge part of what's going on, and thank you for sharing your story. It really makes a difference to have you here. But thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Representative Tice, thank you. And I just think that underscores that this is about the most efficient investments we can be making when you talk about creating that stability early on for families, for children. Then you look long-term in terms of our public costs, in terms of the public education system, et cetera. Starting investing at home stability makes so much sense.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Perkins, thank you for coming and sharing your story with us. Appreciate hearing and seeing you. It's great to hear the impact this has. And I want to say thank you to Ms. Kaufman for the work that you're doing out in our district. It's very important. I remember the opportunity to be able to stop out and see your facility, be able to visit and see how important this program is and the successes that it's happening. I look forward to the pilot program rolling out because it does start making a difference. It's not going to solve all the problems, but every time we get a program like this out there that starts taking bites at it, starts making success occur and starts breaking that cycle that people get trapped in. So I want to say thank you to the author also for advancing the bill.
And Ms. Kaufman, one of the in the area you cited in speaking to one of those superintendents when he gave the number that he believed were homeless children in his school district, he added that he thought there were many more because what happens is they're so shocked when this happens to them, losing a job or health care or some event, and they suddenly have lost their house. They can't believe it. They're embarrassed. They don't want to tell anyone that they're living in their car. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're gradually understanding the nature of this issue. The other research that I heard about this is every time a child needs to move to a different school, that their academic achievement drops several grade levels, too. So the motivations are compelling for this. Any further testimony? That anyone in the audience wants to give, or I think we have no further questions, concluding comments.
We've had a good discussion. I just thank the committee for the support, and this is a worthy investment, and we'll keep working at it.
So Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 1401, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, I think I'll just present from here for the our final, this is our final bill, right? 2542. This is, you've heard all of these bills that are in my delete all, and they're put before you as a policy bill. So I will move House File 2542, and then I will move the DE3 amendment. And the House research summary that you have before you is to the DE amendment. And you will note that it is basically each section is one of the bills that we have heard. All these bills have moved through committee, 1571, 2017, 1574, 2273, 2542, 1511, 495. And thank you to Ms. Dyson and Ms. Mullen for a very comprehensive bill brief. So they are all bills that you've heard, but we have significant numbers of amendments, and so I think maybe we'll... Okay. First of all, I'm going to, I've moved House File 2542, and I've moved the DE3 amendment to get it before us. All in favor of that, delete all, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, that bill is before us. Members, would you like House Research to walk through the bill before we go to amendments? I see a few people who would like that. So, Ms. Mullen or Ms. Dyson?
Chair and members, I'll start and I'll pass it over to Ms. Dyson when we get to the bond sections. Sections 1, 6, and 9 and the repealer in this bill are from House File 1571, which was Representative Howard's bill. It deals with manufactured home park closings. It amends current procedures that exist when a park owner is going to sell the park, and the section updates the notice provisions and the requirements for park residents who want to purchase the park. Sections 2 to 5 and also 10 and 11 are from House File 2017, and they make changes to the Manufactured Home Park Relocation Trust Fund Program, including increasing the balance of the fund.
Madam Chair, the next provision, Section 12, is from House File 1574, and it provides for maintaining affordability of publicly financed housing for at least 30 years, and it's permitting the agency to impose rent income or rent and income restrictions on multifamily rental housing developments as a condition of receiving financial assistance, and that will be effective in 2020.
That was the Hornstein bill, I believe.
Correct. And then Section 13 is from House File 2273, and it's striking language that was added to the omnibus bonding bill last session that would have opened up low-income housing tax credits so that there were no restrictions based on a per-unit cost limitation or reasonableness or other restrictions for the allocation of those. And so this is striking that language that was added in the bonding bill last year. And then sections 14 to 40 are the that's the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act for residential rental housing, and it's defining terms and prioritizing among the types of housing projects, and it represents the consensus items of the housing advocates.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen from House Research.
Mullen.
Thank you. Sections 41 to 43 and then section 47 are from House File 1511, and they amend when the court can grant discretionary eviction expungements and when the court must grant mandatory eviction expungements. These cases can be brought on motion by the defendant, the tenant, but also can be ordered directly by the court. And it also requires evictions to be non-public prior to the court's decision. Sections 43 to 46 are from House File 495, and they add new lease requirements to Chapter 504B. That includes identifying the unit and the move-in and move-out date on leases that tenants sign, and also requiring tenants and landlords to have the same notice periods for increasing rent and move-out. And that's everything.
Any clarification before we go to amendments? All of these, again, were heard. You recall that the one, that bond allocation one, that was the one that came over from Senator Weber. And then we had the, that's an agreement that I think goes back to discussions in 2017 they started with all of the housing advocates. Representative Howard, you have a couple of amendments. We'll start with, I think yours is the A2 is yours.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move the A2.
Representative Howard moves the A2. Please speak to that amendment.
This amendment deals with House File 1571 and is a product of continuing to work with the stakeholders. After this bill was heard in the House Committee, we added some language in working with the manufactured homeowners dealing with putting up the residents or those acting on their behalf putting up earnest money or a bond of some kind in case the deal doesn't go through, and so this language in the amendment addresses that issue and continues to clean up that language.
And you've been working with a variety of stakeholders on the A2. I'm going to just always check if there are members of the audience who want to speak to any of these. Do we have any testimony to the A2? Any questions of committee members? Okay, the A2 is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. And I believe the A6 is yours as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the A6.
Representative Howard moves A6.
Again, this amendment is the product of working with the stakeholders. Members, you might remember we had a discussion in the House committee about language, about who are the residents that would be able to sort of sign on the dotted line to reach the number of 51%, so to speak. And we had a discussion about is the appropriate terminology resident or tenant. And so we've worked to clear that up when we were in front of Commerce to make it clear that we're talking about residents. And this amendment in working that comes from the manufactured homeowners to further clarify that we're talking about a resident who is a signatory to the home's lot lease agreement, just to add further clarification about who is able to be party to that moving forward.
Anyone in the audience who wishes to speak to this amendment? Any questions from the committee? If not, the A6 is before you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those aye. Opposed? That amendment is adopted. And the A3 is a department amendment, and I would ask a member from the department, the A3 is a department amendment, I believe. If you'd come forward to speak to that. All members, when I presented the 2542, that was the bill that came over from Senator Weber, that the department at the time came forward and said there were, I don't know if these are technical in nature or, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Chair Hausman, members of the committee. I'm Ryan Baumtrog, Assistant Commissioner for Policy at Minnesota Housing. Just want to say thank you to the chair and author of the bill. The changes in front of you in the A3 amendment are changes that the agency has provided to help with the administration of the program. This relates to how the state allocates bonds. In this case, it's actually Minnesota Management and Budget that allocates these bonds, and these will help clarify that process. We are continuing to work with Minnesota Management and Budget. They may have additional changes, but to meet the deadline and just to keep the process going, we wanted to get these in front of the committee as soon as we could. So just wanted to say thank you for offering these amendments.
And you would describe that as technical changes to the bill?
Yes, I would say they're largely technical on how the bonds are allocated.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak to this amendment or members' questions to this? If not, the A3 is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
And then we have the A4. Representative Price, is that one yours?
It is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Price.
When we heard 1511, there was quite a bit of concern considering the expungements, and quite frankly, as a landlord, I become responsible. I'm made responsible by some forms of government of what my tenants do, and so it's very hard to look at renting to someone where I really don't know their history. And some folks are very willing to talk about it, which is great. That is just fantastic. At least I know where I'm starting from. But to not know anything that's happened within, you know, several years is really quite concerning. And I think it really does hold a lot of folks back from renting to certain folks. So what this amendment is just putting in some exceptions about, you know, some behaviors that would really be quite concerning if we didn't know about it. And I would ask that folks support this because, I mean, several of them deal with, you know, furnished alcohol, tobacco, and such to minors, and also smoking. We've had no smoking homes for forever, and I can tell you that at one point when a group moved out, we found out that a sofa that they left behind had actually had little beverage holders in the arms, but they also used them for ashtrays. That's really concerning. when I think a house could have burned down because they were using their sofa as an ashtray in a no-smoking home. So I really think it's really hard. I get why there's so many laws with landlords, but gosh darn it, it's really hard to rent out when you can't know anything and you just got to trust the person for what they say. And we've been hit with it several times. And also, evictions are not cheap. I don't want to evict. It costs money. And with that, I think, you know, some of the others can speak if they want to. I wish Nels were here, Representative Pearson, because he was really good at vocalizing what some of those concerns are as well. But in order to have a really good lease where I feel like I'm really leasing to somebody where I know who they are and they're really coming forward and saying, you know, letting me know what's going on as well, just makes a better situation for leasing. I don't want to evict. It's expensive. It takes a lot of time as well. So I just hope that we can get your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Tice. Thank you for bringing this forward. This is really an important issue. When I heard this bill, I've mentioned before, I've been a landlord for 25 years, and mentioned to Representative Tice that last night, a long conversation with my wife, we're having to go through our first eviction process in 12 years. And this is a tenant that moved in 3 months ago and didn't pay rent and hasn't paid rent since they moved in. And has subsequently, there's people living in the property that we don't even know. She went rent, basically sublet the property illegally and collected rent for 2 months from the people that are living there. We have to, you know, it's really frustrating. But the person that we're evicting, I think that future landlords should have a right to know that she's being evicted. She's not going to use me as a reference. So the only thing that landlords can have to see that this is a bad tenant is to have this on record. And to not have her be able to have it expunged, and to make sure that that's on record when it's filed. It's really expensive to evict someone, and we have made reasonable accommodations to try to allow them to get caught up on rent, as we've done in the past, which has always worked out for us, where we haven't had to evict somebody. But this omnibus bill in general removes a lot of landlords' ability to make some reasonable accommodations and exceptions to help tenants stay in the property to make things more affordable. But this provision, where it can be expunged so easily, it makes it difficult for landlords to screen tenants to screen the bad apples out, and to make sure that we can make accommodations for tenants. So I support this amendment, and I think it really lays out some exceptions that prevents expungement of evictions when it's very obvious that these tenants should have been evicted. So thank you again, Representative Tice, for bringing this forward, and would urge members to vote yes.
May we recall, members, when this bill was before us, we had some of this discussion. I wonder if there is anyone in the audience who was present then who testified at that point whether they would be willing to come forward. Do I see? I see one person stepping forward. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record. From Homeline, I believe.
Yes, Representative Chairman. Again, my name is Samuel. I won't repeat my introduction from earlier today. I would say that there are several problems with this amendment. First, it applies to both the discretionary and mandatory expungements. The discretionary expungements already requires the court to make a finding that the case is no longer a reasonable predictor. It would completely remove that discretion from the judge. It would just say you can't do it in any of these cases, regardless of what the circumstances are now. An even bigger problem is that it says if the basis for eviction was because of tenant. Evictions go on a tenant's record the moment that they're filed. They're a public document, so once the case is filed, they're there, which means that a landlord could go file an eviction, be wrong about that eviction, but under this amendment, if the basis for that eviction was one of these categories, the tenant couldn't get it expunged because it was the basis for the eviction. There's no requirement, in other words, of proof. The landlord doesn't have to win an eviction to establish this. So evictions that are just filed alleging things, true or untrue, would stay on a tenant's record. This also is, I think, fairly broad. The evictions often name multiple people. You know, this comes back to the discretionary issue. There are multiple tenants, one of whom may be a roommate, significant other, something along those lines, uses, for example, an illegal substance, a drug. Both tenants might be evicted. If those tenants aren't living together, the tenant who didn't do anything wrong can't go back and get their name expunged or removed under this amendment. I'll end there.
Questions of the testifier? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm noticing that it was saying the basis for the eviction. Right now, the way the language is in the bill, if somebody ended up where the judge found that they were evicted for, say, malfeasance or for violations, how long would that, under the current language, how long would that remain on their form or on their record?
I'm sorry, if I could ask for clarification, do you mean under the laws that exist currently or under the bill as it is without the amendment?
Madam Chair, testifier, it would be under the language in the bill that's being proposed right now.
It would be for at least 3 years. After 3 years, under the mandatory section, it would the tenant would have to make a motion and it could be removed at that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, basically, is if somebody is found to have actually violated this will still be on the record. It will still be available for people to be able to see when they're searching the court document then, correct?
For 3 years, yes.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted that clarity.
Do I see any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to state again that a lot of the things that we're talking about here in the amendment are things that are they're quite serious. And as I said before, I'm made responsible for a lot of the activities that our tenants have simply because we're the landlord. And if I can't really justify, I guess I look at if I can only look 3 years and somebody has been acting very irresponsible, that really is not a good thing to have them. If they know there's a three-year penalty, you know, three-year look at that, we can only look 3 years. Believe me, that'll be known. We've had some really bad actors in several years, and we don't do a lot of evictions. But when we do, it's a scenario very close to what Representative Munson said. They moved in May. We evicted them in April. Never got any money. They never paid us. They got money. They were on services and never gave us a penny. And the house was so ransacked that it took us a lot of money and time to clean it and get it ready for the next people. That's a big investment, plus the investment it takes just to go through the eviction process. And I really think we should have the opportunity to look at some behaviors and say, you know what, we really do need to have a look at this so that we can make good judgments on who we want to rent to. Maybe then it's a way folks, you know, tenants now know that they have to behave well, or they're not going to get maybe another chance for another 3 years. I can see that. But, you know, some of this goes a lot further than that, and it's very expensive. So if we want to talk about keeping housing affordable, then we got to look at some options where we have to also work with landlords and say, you know, yes, we understand why you want to have the opportunity to look back at things like this. And also, Madam Chair, I would like to request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Did you have any follow-up? Representative Johnson?
Representative Chair Hausman, Representative Tice, thank you for bringing this amendment forward because it has some very key issues in it. One, if you have a tenant that's harassing and stalking other tenants, I think a landlord needs to know that because if they rent to somebody, they can be held liable for something happens. It also requires that if a person is engaged in prostitution, selling drugs out of their apartment, possessing illegal firearms, they can be evicted. And the landlord they're looking at a new facility or new place to live can see that. to know that type of person, that maybe there's children around. You don't want that person dealing around those children. Possession of explosive devices, AEDs. It's an issue that we deal with in law enforcement, always are looking for and looking at. Trying to find those things to protect our citizens. Do you want? I've actually been involved where we found a pipe bomb. We want the people, you want that, people that are building those devices in your apartment complex? Absolutely not. And giving alcohol and drugs to kids, you do not want them by your children. This is a very important amendment, and landlords need to know this information because they can be held liable if something happens. If we don't, if they're not allowed to see these things, we might have less landlords and less opportunities for people to rent apartments that need them and even have bigger housing crisis.
Mr. Spade, it did occur to me that in some of these cases, when these are serious crimes, they are probably arrested, convicted, and perhaps in a correctional facility somewhere, and no eviction is going to be necessary because they won't be living there anymore.
That would often be the case, and in many of these cases, even if the eviction was filed and then expunged under this, it doesn't remove the criminal conviction, which landlords also search for and would be able to find.
Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, and I can't remember if I said this in Judiciary or in this particular committee, but I think that what our colleagues here have demonstrated is that we have a lot of great landlords. There are a lot of really good people who try to do right by their renters, but I'm a little bit challenged with this because we also hear on the flip side that there are a lot of people who are wrongfully evicted or people who are treated poorly. We had people who have testified around, asking landlords to do the bare minimum and then them getting evicted because they're asking too much out of landlords. And so I'm challenged with being able to creating these exceptions for this, but for landlords, but I don't know if we have the flip side for tenants who are harassed because of their religion or their race or their gender, the tenants who are treated poorly by their landlords because their landlords won't even keep the units to just basic code sometimes. And so though I'm not opposed to protecting landlords because I do have family members who own properties who rent as well. I have seen the way some of the properties are left after somebody has not been respectful, but I also have seen on numerous occasions, more often than not, people who have been unfairly evicted or treated poorly because of all of these same circumstances. And so I guess what I'm asking the testifiers is that do we have these same types of protections for renters and individuals under these very similar circumstances when they're harassed by their landlord or by other tenants in the building or when they are, they've paid their rent but their landlord doesn't do what they're supposed to be doing to keep the units in good shape. And so I don't know if there is an answer, and maybe there is. I would just like to know if there are the flip side to protect renters as well versus just looking for something to protect the landlords.
Mr. Spade.
In many cases, I would say that there are protections for tenants for that, though you covered a very wide range of landlord activities. There are protections for many of those. Some of them are harder to enforce than others. But especially when we're talking about the difference between, say, expungements of an eviction record or repairs, getting repairs is very important. You know, at Homeline, we often talk tenants through how to do that. But expungements often go to the heart of whether the tenant can find housing and whether the people who live with them can find housing, whether they can live essentially in a home or their car, or a homeless shelter or those types of things, which have a bunch of other costs both to the tenant, their family, and society as a whole.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Trying to figure out how to make an argument here so that the other side can actually listen to understand how important this issue is for me and for landlords. It is right now we have a housing shortage. That's why we're here. We're discussing legislation to help us make the right decisions and improve, get more landlords involved in building housing. What I've gone through in the last week dealing with this potential eviction is put such a distaste in my mouth for being a landlord that I don't even want to do it anymore. It's frustrating dealing with tenants that take advantage of a situation like this. And what when you have a housing shortage, you have a lot of people that apply for the apartment when you have a unit that's up. And landlords have discretion of choosing who they want to have as tenants. We have kind of rules that we put in place on first in, if they meet the background check and whatever, that we'll choose. But you're taking away from us something that allows us to make a decision based in fact. I can look at all these tenants, regardless of race, religion, my gut feeling from meeting them, and I can make a decision based in fact. This person may not look the most appealing tenant to me based on whatever other stuff that might influence my decision, but if I know they don't have an eviction, then I can take a chance on that person. I feel so sorry for someone who falls into this class of people where they have a high rate of evictions that they're discriminated against because people might think that they had an eviction that was expunged, or that something isn't that the landlord can't make a decision based on fact. And having this information out there that just says that an eviction is that they had an eviction allows me to make the right decision and take a chance on a tenant who's doing everything right and did not have an eviction. If you take this away from me, then you're gonna have other landlords that make decisions that aren't based on fact, and that's where we're not being fair to people. That's why this is such an important amendment that I think is going to help us make the right decision. Yes, there are bad actors out there, Representative Herr, and there are bad landlords that are evicting people that shouldn't. And you fix that by changing eviction law. You don't change the rental law based on something that is bad. Go and fix the actual the process by which you evict somebody in judiciary. But don't do it here, penalizing landlords, which this bill, if we don't accept this amendment, we're going to increase costs. I this is the first eviction that I've done for a property that's owned by a business. As many of you have realized, working at the legislature, you lose a significant amount of income to come do this, or many of you might. And under federal Fannie Mae guidelines for underwriting, I can't buy a house or even refinance my home because my income's dropped more than 20%. So I have to get a business, a commercial loan for properties, and I have to put it in a commercial name. And I find out yesterday that when you evict somebody, if it's owned by a business, you can't, as the owner, you can't represent yourself in court. My wife went to law school. She can't even represent herself. You have to go hire a law firm. But the tenant laws, because of lobbyists like this, they got through that says I can only charge $5 for my attorney fee if we successfully evict somebody. That really penalizes landlords. That increases our costs. That's an example of the tenant-landlord pendulum that swung so far in favor of tenants. Yeah, yeah. Now, I don't want to wait at all if I have to evict somebody. Now I'm out 3 months' rent, probably a security deposit, and I can't even recapture attorney's fees, and I have to hire a law firm to come in and represent us. This is frustrating. I want to lower the cost of rent, but you guys keep on adding to our expenses as landlords, and it's frustrating. This amendment would allow me to make a proper decision based on a tenant application, based on fact, and not just choosing the tenant that's going to best suit me, but actually allowing me to take a chance on people. So I know if you've caucused this amendment, you've said we're going to vote against any Republican amendments. I'd urge you to consider this one. It still gives you a lot of what you want, but it's a compromise, and it's going to help lower the cost of rent.
I'll be brief. I know we'll be back working on these issues, but I do want to speak against the amendment. And looking at the language of the bill and some of the egregious examples that have been sort of discussed, I think would be covered under this no longer reasonable predictor. Some of the scenarios I think would be a predictor,
Can you cite a page?
So I'm looking at line 34.2.0. If the court makes the following findings, the eviction case file is no longer a reasonable predictor of future tenant behavior. I think some of the egregious issues we're talking about would be a reasonable predictor. But the tenants that I want to just talk about are, and I think are probably the majority of folks who this legislation is important for, aren't folks that have participated in some malicious behavior, aren't folks that have created some scheme to, you know, make their own money, in, as Representative Munson's example. But it's folks that, you know, might have lost a job and fallen on hard times and not being able to afford rent. Someone that maybe their mother or their father passed away and they had to attend to their funeral and fell behind on rent. You know, somebody who was fleeing a situation of domestic abuse. Some of those Minnesotans end up with an eviction on their record, and it's a black mark that they cannot come out from. And those are the Minnesotans that I think why this particular part of the bill is important, to look at expungements for Minnesotans that aren't, you know, committing some sort of malicious act. But because of our current structure, and I do think that the in terms of the pendulum, I think the power structure does lie more so with our landlords versus our tenants. And this is a reasonable way to provide a path for Minnesotans to sort of get out from this black mark of an eviction when they've fallen on hard times and are in a position to come back and have stable housing going forward. And this amendment, I think, is a little too prescriptive on some of those items and wouldn't allow for that flexibility, and so I'd speak against it.
We're going to go with Representative Gunther, and then concluding comments from you, and then concluding comments from Representative Tice, if you could. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think we have to watch what we're doing here, because the pendulum can't swing too much one way or the other. I, at one time, owned 47 apartments. Because of problems with tenants and the way they left my property, I own zero today. I enjoyed a lot of those tenants, and I hated some of them. But only after they stepped on me did I dislike them. I did everything I could. If they had a problem, I never had a search company ever search a tenant's ability to be a good tenant. There are those organizations out there. That does nothing more or less than raise the rent, because every tenant that doesn't watch his bottom line, is or landlord doesn't watch his bottom line, isn't going to be a landlord very long. And 47 apartments are no longer there in Fairmont, Minnesota area because of some bad tenants. At the same time, I've known slum landlords that I wouldn't recommend anybody rent an apartment from. So we got to watch where that pendulum swings. This is the only thing going in favor of the landlord that I've seen in this committee. Everything has been skewed towards the tenant. Don't let the pendulum swing too much, or you're going to cut your nose off to spite your face.
Mr. Spade, any concluding remarks?
Thank you. I'll keep it very brief. Certainly, I understand the issues with tenants who do terrible things, a pipe bomb in the building, for example. But this amendment, as it is, simply isn't specific enough to those things. It also includes much less serious issues, such as not paying rent for two or more consecutive months, which could just be to a financial problem, or repeatedly smoking in a smoke-free building. Those are not on the same level as a pipe bomb, and yet both are included. And second, it's just the bright line nature of this rule. It just says you can't get an expungement if one of these things exists. It doesn't allow for discretionary expungement, for example. It's not just dealing with the mandatory expungements. It's dealing with these discretionary ones where, again, there might be other factors, multiple tenants where one of them should have it expunged and maybe the other one shouldn't, et cetera. So I would just say that as written here, it doesn't quite get at some of those concerns the way I think that it might be intended to.
Representative Price, final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to let Representative Hur know that in St. Cloud, when you apply for a rental license, you have to take a training. You know, it's just mandatory. So a lot of places, I think, do that as well, so that we know what we can do and what we can't do. And that's a good thing. But I think my hair just stood up when you mentioned a pipe bomb versus smoking repeatedly in an apartment. And I would say I almost think smoking repeatedly in an apartment is worse than finding a pipe bomb. Because smoke will mean, in a smoke-free building, means I got to clean that bugger up as good as I can, because I'm advertising it as a smoke-free building, and smoke is one of the hardest things to get out. So that means I'm reflooring, repainting, I'm cleaning everything I can And so to make it sound like that's a trivial thing is grossly not. It makes a big difference. And yet part of it is those are the rules of the game. When you rent the place, you're renting a smoke-free building. That is part of what you agree to. And so that kind of got me a little hot when you kind of made that. I would rather someone not smoke than anything else. And we've had folks that have done that. As I said, we had a group that cut little things in the couch and used those for ashtrays. Wow, you know, that just blew our mind when we found that. And we didn't know it until after they had moved out and left half of their stuff there because it was horrible. You got some time, I'll tell you the whole case of that one. I mean, it's a lot of work to get an apartment back again. So with that, I just hope you can find a place where we can truly look at some of these things and realize that it is a deal breaker for some folks for renting out apartments. And also, if we want to keep costs down, it means we have to have good tenants as well as good landlords. Thank you.
Members, we're going to have a roll call vote on this. I would recommend a no vote on the amendment. The bill itself has a very little step toward tenants' rights. We haven't done much for tenants' rights for quite a number of years, and this moves a little bit in that direction, as Representative Howard mentioned, that pendulum needs to be balanced a bit. So I would recommend a no vote on the A4, and please take the roll.
Houseman?
No.
Howard?
No.
Tice?
Yes.
Bierman?
No.
Fisher?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hassan? Burr?
No.
Bornstein?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Juergens?
Yes.
Monson?
Yes.
Pearson? Poppy?
No.
Sock?
No.
Eight to five, that amendment is defeated. Members, we have two more amendments, and the next committee is waiting outside. And so, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to come back. Can you give us the room and time? 1:20 in the Capitol, we could not get a room here at 6:30, so we'll have the last two amendments and then final passage of the bill. We are in recess.
Meeting will come to order. Thanks to Representative Johnson, who made the great catch on the minutes. We have minutes in better order, and which you've already had a chance to look at. So should we look at the March 13th first?
Actually, I will move both.
Okay.
March 13th and March 20th minutes. I've reviewed them, but they appear to be correct.
All right. Any other changes or corrections to the minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The minutes are approved. And thanks, Mr. Johnson, for that. And we have House File 2542 before us. We were under amendments, and I think we have three more. And we'll begin, Representative Sock, with the A8. You can do it from the seat. Unless you have a testifier you want to join you.
No.
No.
I don't think.
Okay. Representative Sock moves the A8.
You got to get the paperwork in front of me. I'm looking at the minutes.
Should have warned you.
So the amendment basically is trying to expand a couple of elements that are already part of the normal function of supporting more affordable housing. And so on the A8, you'll see the section subdivision 4, which is adding manufactured home parks as one of the identified users or approved users for the home improvement fund money. Then the under section 6, again, it's a matter of adding the manufactured home parks for that particular funding stream, and then also following down in 116, again, is the addition of manufactured homes defined in a longer term simply because of the definitions that the product will use when it's in that kind of funding. So it's basically adding those kinds of things, additional uses. And I notice also in 2.6, I should mention that one, where an added use would be for acquisition purposes.
And Representative Salk has been a believer that manufactured homes are one of our answers to affordable housing and has been a constant.
Yeah, I'm a pretty persistent about that dialogue. If you think of buyers of home and housings in strata, because we always do that, we got homes that we know some people can afford that others can't and that sort of thing, but the strata keep going. But you get down into the very lowest strata, it's very difficult to find anything at all that is available in the market. And when you do that kind of analysis, you will find in almost any community that mobile homes will fit in on that particular level. In fact, I was chatting with the MFHA gentleman out in the hallway, and we had a lot of dialogue about how we as a society, if you will, or a community, are addressing the needs of the people that fall to the lowest levels of income, both affordability and or qualification. So that's, you're right, I'm very passionate about how important it is that we have things for that group of people to use.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, this is actually a very good amendment in my area. Actually, not so much in my district, but just north of me. There's a lot of manufactured and modular homes. It's a great way to start out. It's a great starter home. The manufacturing of them, the way they're built now, is totally different than they were 40 years ago. A lot of them, if you go into, you'd never even know that they were a modular home. So I think this is a good amendment.
Any other questions or discussion to the amendment? All in favor?
I'll just make one more point. And that, another thing that some people still have to get in their head, and that is there is underlying funding that's available in the market through various agencies, more than just one, that will fund and support through loans and mortgages the purchase of mobile homes. So they are a fluid part of the market as well. Thank you.
No further discussion. All in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, that amendment is adopted. And I think we'll move on to the A5, and I believe that is Representative Tice.
Madam Chair, at this time, I'm not going to do it.
Okay. A5 has been withdrawn, and there is an A7, which is Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, we heard quite a bit about this issue dealing with the lease agreements around the University of Minnesota. I'm doing some checking in my community and other places around the state. It just seems to be the issue is pretty much located around the university. And so what this amendment does is pretty much just keeps it in the city of Minneapolis where the university is located the actual bill doesn't hurt the rental issues that and the rental properties that we have in the rest of the state where we already have other issues with a very much lack of rental units. So this would just keep that issue confined mostly to the university area where they're having the issue.
And Representative Johnson, interestingly, we had a bill that did that. It was the Representative Dean bill, and we subsequently heard the Noor bill instead, which took it more broadly. I was thinking our Representative, I'm blanking, I'm so bad on names, Representative Munson is not here because he might have a feeling about if it just applies to Minneapolis landlords, that might be have a different point of view for him, however. Discussion to the A7. Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair,
I have a son at the U living in St. Paul, and he's facing the same thing with renters and renting in places like this right now. So, I mean, just him and his friends, he's had some conversation with us over the same issues, and I would take a more broad view of this. I think that putting lease restrictions, or I guess making sure that renters and landlords are clear about the terms of a lease and that this abuse as far as days go where they're cut off for cleaning and that sort of thing, that happens elsewhere too, and I think this is a good bill to protect tenants, and I think it's clear cut. I think it really needs to be for everywhere, not just the city of Minneapolis. That would be, if Minneapolis wanted to set their own restrictions, that would be a different deal, but I think it's a good bill for Minnesotans border to border.
I too would suggest a no vote on this for that very reason, that more broadly there are probably other people caught up in some of those same issues, so I would suggest a no vote on this amendment. Any further, Representative Johnson?
Madam Chair, members, around the university is a special area. They have, from the time their lease runs out to the releasing of the M, 2 weeks to redo every single apartment in those buildings. Does not give a lot of time. That just happens around the university. The rest of the state, except where there might be some colleges, not as big as the university, because the university is huge compared to the other campuses that we have across the state, it makes it a special situation around the university. Most places, apartment complexes across the state, it could be a 50-unit building, they might only have two apartments that are going empty at the end of a month, where they have time to get those units done. But if you start doing 100 units or more in a week or two, that's hard to do, and that's why it's special around the university. So I think this is actually would be good. Even if we could narrow it down to the university area, a location around the university, I think that would be the way to go.
Coincidentally, I represent the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. It's a couple of blocks from my house, and my granddaughter attends Hamline University in St. Paul, and has given me some of the complexity of her life as they rent. And so it probably is unique to college communities generally. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, one more. So my business is in the flooring business, and I do a lot of apartments, and I do a lot of care centers, and we're having to deal with turns all the time, and we're under that gun to get in late in the day and finish by noon the next day so the next tenant can move in. And so I know what renters and landlords are facing with that turn. You don't want to have days where you're not collecting rent. But one of the people I work with as supervisor at one of the retirement communities in Burnsville, he worked extensively and for years down in Mankato. And he said they have the same issue down there where it's a rush to turn buildings like overnight. And they have to bring in extra crews to do cleaning so that things get done. And I understand there's a lot of work to flip those things and to get them cleaned up. But I just don't think it should be put on tenants ever to have to accommodate. And that's the main part of this bill is the date and getting that straightened out. And so I think it's more than just Minneapolis, and I would not want to see it just for Minneapolis. I think all these communities that deal with that, whether it's even if it's not even college stuff, I mean it's just the fundamental rule of paying for what you're getting for and understanding what those dates are. And landlords, they have to be very creative to get those turns done. They have to bring people like me in to get work done. But the other thing is tenants are accommodating. You know, if there's something broken and it needs to be fixed and they want to move in, landlords and tenants can work together on that. We go in after the new people have moved in some cases and do the work while they're living there and have to move their stuff to one side or one room, and we work with them too, and we work with the landlord too. It can all be done that way. So I do it regularly, so I know what you're up against as far as landlords go. So I think I see both sides of it, but I think it's got to be a fairness issue. We need to protect people on not signing for a month when they don't get a month, and allow cleaners, like you referenced. You know, I have heard that cleaners, they get extra 2 weeks to clean, but then that just makes it so that they can come in on any day that works for the cleaning schedule. So the onus then is on the cleaners to pick up the slack.
Representative Pearson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, we get in this language where we're protecting one group over another, and the implication there is that there's abuse going on. And there's this one-sided aspect of this transaction. And the consequence of this legislation is an increase in the costs spread out over a narrower window of time with a limited labor market, which is just going to drive up the costs for doing the things that you've talked about. And the protections are there in this market. And again, what you're now doing is spreading that across the entire state of Minnesota. And I actually, when we heard this bill, we touched on the statute of frauds, the fact that these are one-year leases. Well, now they're under a year. So actually, they don't need to be in writing. You're actually creating a huge loophole that any landlord could drive their leases through without even getting these things in writing, because it's for less than 1 year. So I really think that this component of the bill is ill-suited, and it's certainly ill-suited for any place outside of the protected market that we have, this constituency that we're so concerned about. I would ask that people support the amendment so that it doesn't damage the entire rental market throughout the state of Minnesota, increase the cost for everyone, only negatively impacts those folks who are in the city of the first class. Is that the one we're on?
Yep.
Yeah, thank you. That's above 400,000 people.
Representative Johnson, final comment?
Final comment is I've actually worked with my father-in-law working 24 hours painting apartments. It's a lot of work. And then once the painters get done, then the carpet layers and the floors come in. Once that gets done, electricians come in to replace all the lights. When that gets done, the cleaning crew comes in to clean up after the mess. When you start doing 100 apartments in a complex but along the university, it gets expensive. I can see that. But when you're trying to do that again throughout the entire state of Minnesota with what this is requiring here, it's going to be a burden, and it's going to increase the costs. And with that, I request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested on A7. We have one more speaker, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to echo on how important this bill is. Yes, we are protecting one group over another. We're protecting our poor Minnesotans. We're protecting students. We're protecting people who are, hacked by landlords all the time. And if it doesn't happen in some districts, lucky you, it happens in our districts a lot. We have landlords that are scheming tenants all the time, showing them nicer apartments, renting them to poorly untaken care of units. So I don't support the amendment, and I think this is a good bill. Thank you.
All right, clerk will call the roll.
Houseman?
No.
Howard?
No.
Tice?
Yes.
Bierman?
No.
Fisher?
No.
Gunther? Hassan?
No.
Herr?
No.
Hornstein? Johnson?
Yes.
Juergens? Munson? Pearson?
Aye.
Poppy? Sock?
No.
Seven to three, this amendment fails. And that is the last amendment we have, members. And now it is to the bill. The delete all of 2542 is before us. Any further discussion to the bill? Final passage on 2542. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. We have a testifier. I don't have an agenda in front of me, so I'm sorry. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I know it's late, and I'm standing between you guys and the door, so I apologize. John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We've testified on the eviction expungement portions of this bill before, so I won't rehash that testimony. There's also a memo in your packet. I just wanted to make two main points quickly. The first is the conversation this morning sort of got here, but every time we talk about landlord-tenant issues, you were really talking about three parties, not just a landlord, a tenant. We're also talking about everybody else who lives in a building that's affected by this legislation. And that's why tenant screening is important, because it's not just for protecting the physical and financial integrity of the property, and it's not just for the safety, it's also for the safety and welfare of other tenants, and to make sure that the applicant themselves can succeed in the rental unit, in the rental situation. And eviction records are a part of, not the only part, but a part of rental screening, because they may contain behavioral or payment history that is not available through other means. The second point is just that transparency in public records are important. Expungements are extremely narrow across the board, and particularly in the civil court context. And in fact, the narrow availability of eviction expungements now are the only types of civil court records that can be expunged. I think this is underscored, the importance of that is underscored for both tenants and landlords. The importance of it for landlords is obvious. You want to make sure that somebody can meet the screening criteria for the reasons I just said, which are that you want to make sure that they can succeed in the situation. The importance of it for tenants was underscored in the Governor's Housing Finance Task Force report, which is part of the recommendation, said, quote, best practices should include transparency to allow renters readily access information they need to know about a landlord's track record regarding citations and eviction frequency. So limiting the availability of these records quite dramatically is going to infringe on that ability of renters. I think the unfortunate outcome in some cases is going to be increased disruption and more evictions. But thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Other questions, Mr. Reynolds? Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reynolds, do you believe in due process?
Yeah, I think that there is due process in the current civil court record, and I think that's why transparency is important to ensure that for the general public, as well as for landlords and tenants, that courts are getting, that we can know that courts are delivering fair and consistent and impartial outcomes, and that's why public records are important, and that's why court records are open.
Any follow-up?
Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Mr. Reynolds, if you believe in due process, what we're doing with this expungement is due process. when you file an eviction, no one should see that eviction until the court rules, until the final judgment. And there are plenty of evictions that have been wrongly filed. So no one should have, that should not be public information until the judge who sees that file makes the final note that says this is the right eviction or this is wrongfully filed. That's what we're doing. I just want to remind the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Spade, would you want to address this as well? Welcome back, but please identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Samuel Spade. I'm the attorney for Homeline. I think that you've talked a lot in this committee about the eviction process. I think one of the things that has been brought up, but I would like to touch on it again, is that this is the current process that we have was established a long time ago. We didn't foresee the wide use of electronics in the way that we have now. And unfortunately, it's created the system where there are simply tens of thousands of evictions that exist on people, many of whom shouldn't have had these evictions on their record in the first place. This simply allows people to have that removed from their record and allows them to rent or to have the opportunity to rent without these black marks on their record when they shouldn't be there. Landlords don't care why the evictions were filed. They don't generally look at who won. They simply care that it was filed. And that's the problem that tenants are facing as a whole, is that these evictions, regardless of the underlying issues, regardless of whether they were settled, payment plans, anything like that, they exist and they're affecting people, their families, the ability to rent, have a home, and continue with their lives.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Spade? I don't see any further questions or amendments. We're ready for final passage on House File 25, Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, members, we haven't had any discussion on the bill itself yet, and I'm not sure if anybody wants any, but I do have some concerns on this bill, especially with the expungement issue. So I was sitting there thinking that a couple of years ago, we already changed the expungement record to make it easier to expunge those records. All a person has to do is, we did that, I believe, 3 years ago. Made expungement much easier. Also, doing this on the evictions, automatically expunging them, or making them not available for the landlords to look into things, it's a liability issue for the landlords, and it's a safety issue for the tenants, also, the other tenants in that issue, or in that building. Because landlords want to make sure they have the best qualified and people that aren't going to hurt other members in the complex. But I also see a lot of other civil court cases being filed now. Landlords aren't the dumbest person on the street. We have some very good landlords, and we have some bad ones that are going to abuse the system no matter what we do. And I already can see how they're going to abuse the system again, so we'll be back here trying to deal with it. And that's going to be a file. If they don't pay their rent and if they don't evicted for non-payment of rent, they're going to take them to court in civil court to get their money back that way, get a judgment on them. And that's going to show up for these people to see. And those are even worse because now the judge has ordered, even though they don't live there, they might have 8 months left of their rent after they got evicted. They might have to go off 8 months worth of rent. And some judges might do that, because they violated the terms of their contract or lease agreement and they were evicted, but the judge might still find them liable for the rest of that rent. And that judgment will be on their record permanently, making it even harder for them to get find a place to rent. So, but that's just one of the few things that I have problems with this in this bill. There's a couple good things, but there's a lot of bad things, so I cannot support it.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Which reminded me, I just pulled out the House research brief again. Ms. Dyson and Ms. Mullen went through it this morning, I think. And just to remind you, this is a composite of a number of bills that we have heard, and I'll just briefly talk about a few of them. One on notice and negotiation on a manufactured home park when the purchaser plans to convert the use of the park, make changes to the manufactured home park relocation trust fund program, maintaining affordability of publicly financed housing, changes 2018 language governing use of low-income housing tax credits, makes changes to the Minnesota bond allocation for residential rental housing. This was, going back to 2017, a number of stakeholders at the table. I don't know if they actually spent 2 years doing it, but though there were five items that were agreed to by all of the stakeholders. That is in this one. And then, of course, the one section that we're just talking about here. So that is the nature of the bill. I don't see any further discussion about that. The House Bill 2542 is before us for final passage. We don't have a roll call. No. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 2542 is passed. Now, members, thanks to Representative Tice, also did a catch this morning on an amendment. The announcement of that is that 2542 is being referred to Ways and Means. We're going to revisit House File 1402. We're just bringing it back. Whatever you'd like.
Okay. Save about 20 steps up there. It's a lot of we had to walk over to the Capitol. So, thank you, Representative Tice. We've been working with stakeholders since we had the hearing this morning related to the amendment to the Local Housing Trust Fund that we adopted. We've made some changes to that to clarify in an A3 amendment. So let me get my procedure.
So members, we're bringing 1402 back to the table. And you've got
And first I will move to reconsider the 1402 A2 amendment, which we had adopted previously this morning.
We are reconsidering, members, the vote on A2. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, that is before us again.
And I'll withdraw that amendment, Madam Chair.
A2 is withdrawn.
And now I would like to move the A3 amendment.
Representative Howard moves A3 to speak to the amendment, please.
And members,
and I think you've worked this through with stakeholders too.
Indeed, we've worked with stakeholders, and I think found a solution that seeks to achieve the same goal, but without requiring a stakeholder task force. The amendment before us would simply state that before the agency makes any grants, that the commissioner shall consult with interested stakeholders developing the guidelines and procedures. Rather than create a task force or a stakeholder group. And that is the contents of the A3 amendment.
Representative Tice.
Madam Chair, should we be reconsidering the bill or just
this
the amendment?
This one we just held over.
Okay.
And so we just brought it back on the table.
Thank you.
And in fact, we'll be holding it over today, too.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, glad that we got that cleared up so that we don't have to worry about it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Two good catches today.
And with that, what
are there questions to the A3? Not all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? A3 is before us, and now your bill is as you wanted it, and we will lay the bill over for possible consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we I think we have finished. I don't see any other outstanding questions. We are adjourned.